Welcome to the Let Good Things In show. I'm your host, Amanda Acker. I'm so happy you're here. At the Let Good Things In show, we talk all about second chances, resiliency, following your intuition, and even music. Listen to hear stories of hope and to be inspired. Remember, you are stronger than you think. Let's dive in. Hi, my amazing humans. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I'm so excited to be bringing you my guest today, Craig Stanland. After hitting rock bottom, Craig Stanland was forced to make a choice, give up or rebuild. He thought he had it all until he lost sight of what's truly important and made the worst decision of his life, losing everything along the way, including his own self-worth. Through the painful, terrifying process of starting over, Craig ultimately discovered that when you have nothing, anything is possible. Today, Craig is an author, speaker, and reinvention architect. He specializes in working with people whose lives have fallen apart, helping them reinvent themselves by showing them how to rebuild their self-worth and create the extraordinary lives they've always wanted. Welcome to the show, Craig. So happy you're here.
Amanda, I'm so excited for our conversation. I am looking forward to this.
Great. Awesome. So could you tell us all a little bit about, you know, your story, where you've come from, and how you've got to where you are today?
Absolutely. Because I think that bio definitely alludes to some things that might intrigue the audience and say, what exactly happened for all of that to occur? So in 2012, and let's say so it was September 30th, 2012, I had what most people would say was it all. I had the homes, I had the beautiful wife, I had the nice cars, the fancy watches, I ate at the best restaurants in Manhattan and Greenwich, Connecticut. I was living the life. On October 1st, I lost everything. Mm-hmm. Because on October 1st, that's the day I was arrested by the FBI. For just under 10 months, I had committed fraud against one of the largest technology companies in the world. And it all came to a head on October 1st when I had arrived in my brand new job with people I didn't even know. And I received the following voicemail. Mr. Stanland, this is Special Agent McTiernan with the FBI. We are at your residence and have a warrant for your arrest. You need to call us and come home immediately, or we will issue a warrant with the federal marshals. And that is just the day, obviously, that my life changed. I pled guilty because I was sentenced to 2 years of federal prison, and I lost everything all along the way. I lost the career, the money, my wife, the homes. I lost my identity and my sense of value and worth. And it's been just a tremendous journey back to where I am today, being what I call a reinvention architect, helping other people reinvent themselves, a TEDx speaker, a best-selling author. And it's just been a wild ride, and I'm sure you and I are going to get into that very soon.
Yes. Yeah, that's amazing. You know, when you mentioned, you know, you got that call from the FBI, like I've been arrested. I know what that feels like, but I don't know what it feels like to have an FBI agent call me and tell me they're at my home. And that had to have been so horrifying. That whole piece right there, when you told me that before, I was like, oh my gosh, like my heart just like dropped for you. You know, that's horrifying. So could you tell us, you know, maybe a little bit about what happened after that call? Like what transpired? Like what did you have to go through after receiving that call? Like the emotions you were going through?
The first emotion was so interesting because I knew what I was doing was wrong. I knew when I started the fraud, I knew it was wrong. So the first thing was my heart just chimed in and said, I told you so. Mm. And that just hurt. But then it was sheer terror. Like you said, it was just sheer, absolute terror. So I had started this new job, which was in Manhattan, and my home was in Connecticut. So I had about an hour drive home, driving into the unknown. But fortunately for that hour, I was able to set up representation. That was a huge step of it. I was able to call my father. But when I pulled into my community, lived in a gated community, and I drive through the gates and I make the turn down the hill, and it was just like out of a movie. Mm-hmm. There were so many agents. There were so many vehicles. And it just, my body, I almost went into autopilot at that time, at that point. It was just so much to take in. And that's when I was arrested and I asked them not to put the cuffs on me. I really didn't want the handcuffs. I am 5'4". At the time, I weighed 140 pounds. I'm not a large individual. And I said, I was like, look at me, I'm not a threat. And they said, you have to, it's procedure. Because I knew when those handcuffs on, that meant it was really, it was real. And it was final. So I was handcuffed, brought to the courthouse in Bridgeport, where I was handed over to the federal marshals and processed. And for anybody who doesn't know what processing is, that is the fingerprinting, the DNA, a lot of questions, and then the strip search, which is just one of the most humiliating things that a person can go through. So it's just swarmed in uncertainty and fear and going through all of these things that I have no idea what they are. I have no idea what's going to happen. I have no idea where I am. It was so much emotion and so much terror that it's hard to describe.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I was like, you know, I mean, it is. It's just so much. And that's actually when I was brought to my arraignment, where I was released on bail and then was able to, very fortunately, go back to my home. And that's just when that whole process of pleading guilty and getting sentenced, all of that began. That began maybe the hardest 10 months of my life.
Yeah, I agree with you. I know I can completely relate to pretty much all that you've said. You know, for me, it was, you know, I was arrested at gunpoint on like this busy road, you know, face down on the pavement. It was a horrifying experience. And, you know, when you're going through these experiences, you don't even know what you're feeling. It's just like this sheer, like you said, it's that terrified, like, oh no, I have no clue where I'm going, number one. Number two, who am I going to encounter and how is this all going to pan out? Like, is what's happening going to ruin my life? Can I get out of this? I know for me, I thought, oh, like, maybe I can get out of this. Like, I know I'm caught, I'm busted, but there has to be a way out. But there's not, you know, and then you get there in the strip search. Yes, that is one of the most degrading experiences I as well have been through. Like, you're just, like you say in your book too, like, you're no longer a human. Like, you become, you know, this shell of a person. And, you know, when you talk about the time in between, so, you know, when you're out on bail, and, you know, that was also that was the darkest, I think mine was like 8 to 10 months as well, period of my life, because I didn't know what was going to happen to me. You know, you're waiting, like, okay, what's the sentence going to be? What, you know, what's going to happen? So could you tell us, you know, kind of like what your experiences were from the time you were out on bail to the time that you were actually sentenced and went to prison?
You used the key word in there. It's just uncertainty. And our brains crave certainty. So uncertainty just flies in the face of what our brains want. And I didn't know if I was going to prison, what kind of prison I was going to. I was told, and she meant this in a good way, but my pretrial probation officer told me, do not watch any prison shows. It's only going to scare you. So I didn't do any, and she said, don't do any research, don't look into prisons, just don't do it, stay away from it because it's going to scare you. So I listened to her, and I thought, being the small guy that I am, I said, I'm going to go to a prison like I see in Oz, and I'm going to be raped and beaten every single day because I'm just not a large human.
Right.
And I thought that for so long, and the uncertainty and the terror of that was so overwhelming. And it wasn't until I met somebody who runs an organization that helps people pre-prison, in prison, and post-prison, where he explained I'd be going to a federal prison camp, which I'd be with other white-collar offenders. Most likely I'd be going there based on my crime. He couldn't guarantee it. And that took a little bit of that weight off, but it was still there because, am I going to go to prison? Am I not going to go to prison? My pretrial probation officer looked at my case and he said, you know, you should get probation based on this. My attorney said, you're going to prison. So I've got two polar opposites. Oh. And I had to believe my attorney because I had to prepare for that. I was hoping for probation, but right. I had to believe my attorney. I had to prepare mentally that this was going to occur. So I've got all of that terror. But now that my career is over, the money is, you know, basically all gone. I had to, with my now ex-wife, she had just started a business. So we had to make sure that this thing was sustainable, that it could keep a roof over her head, that it could keep food in the fridge. So we were just working long, hard days to make sure that this business was going to be viable and that it was going to last during my sentence. And it was that tenuous relationship for 10 months of the uncertainty, working our butts off and just not knowing what the heck was going to happen. And on top of that, it was that uncertainty is like a dark cloud that followed me everywhere. It just, everything was stained with that. And I also felt that I was wearing a scarlet letter that only I could see. I thought that going into the gas station to pay for gas or to get a bottle of water, it was like the guy behind the counter knows that I'm going to be a convicted felon. He knows. And I don't know how much ego is involved in that or just shame is involved in that. But I thought every single person knows. And it's, I was alive and breathing, but I wasn't really existing, if that makes sense. Yeah. And that really captures those 10 months. And I'm not sure, can you relate to that with your 8 to 10 months?
Is that accurate? Yes. So accurate. For me too, like, yeah, when you mentioned, like, you thought everyone knows, like, that literally haunted me. Like, everybody knows, you know? So you would go, I would go into like a store as well and be like, oh, they all know, they're all looking at me, all eyes on Amanda, because she's, you know, she's gonna, could possibly go up, you know, I could have gone to upstate prison for 5 years based on my crime. And, you know, scared to death, you don't know, like, you can't, it's almost like you can't make a decision on anything because you just, I started my story, you know, I started going even worse down the path. So like, I didn't have, you know, money or anything like that. I was very poor. So I was constantly like, okay, like, how can I get a job? But then I'm scared, like, oh, are they going to look into my background? Is it already there? Like, I don't know, you know? So it would keep me from being able to make my life better in that time frame because I was so ashamed of myself. It was shame and just that fear of, I don't know what my life looks like. I have no trajectory of how I can create a good life for me and my son at the time. Like, I literally had no idea what was going to happen. And it was really scary, like you said. And then when you think, you know, that everyone knows, it's hard to be yourself. It's hard to go after anything that's good, you know, like, oh, go to college, Amanda, which I did. I tried that. But then the whole time there, everyone knows. And that's all I could focus on. So no, I didn't do well because I was so worried about my life as a whole. So I can completely relate to all of that for sure. It's a horrible time. And I hope that people who are listening, if you haven't experienced this, I don't want any of you to have to ever experience this. It's a horrible thing to go through.
And if I could add to that, I hope that nobody has to experience that as well. But if you do, or you know somebody who is, it's temporary. It's temporary. It's awful and it's horrible. Probably the worst thing you may ever experience, but it's temporary. And just to remember that.
Yeah, that's very true too. You know, because when you're in those moments, you know, you also think, this is my life. This is it. This is forever. You know, like, I'll never be able to amount to anything. I've ruined my entire life. My family is ashamed of me. And you think that, but it's, you know, you can overcome it, you know, and that's why I'm so excited to be talking with you, because you have tremendously overcome and your book is amazing. And, but that's taking me a little bit off subject, but, you know, after you were, done with, you know, getting out on bail and you got sentenced and now you're in prison, can you tell us about that experience, about going into prison and what it was actually like when you were there?
Walking into prison is one of the most surreal, difficult experiences I've ever known. Saying goodbye to my wife in the lobby. It's a lobby like an ugly hotel, and you literally check in. You walk to the front desk and you give your name and you sit and wait to be called. And the check-in process is also dehumanizing. It's very much similar to the federal marshals. It was the DNA, it was the fingerprint, it was the strip search all over again. And I had to check in. So I didn't end up going to a federal prison camp. However, the majority of federal prison camps are attached to a medium security prison, and you have to check in at the medium security prison. So that is with the giant fences, with the guns in the, you know, the guys with the guns in the towers. They brought me into the catacombs of this scary, scary building. I have no idea where I was. And I was led to a cell, and the guard didn't say anything. He just opened the door, and I knew I had to walk in. And the moment I crossed that threshold, he slammed the door behind me. And the sound of a prison cell door closing is one of the most visceral, powerful sounds I have ever known. It was the death of my freedom at that moment. And I just held my head. There was in this journey, there's just steps of reality that keep making themselves known, where I found the rock bottom just slipping further and further and further. Every single time I thought I had hit bottom, there was a new yeah. bottom. And checking in was, like I said, surreal, because this is the surreal part. I go through all of that. I'm in the catacombs of this medium security facility. They brought me out the same way I came in, and brought me out the front door that I walked in, out into the parking lot. And they say, and I was with somebody else who was getting checked into the camp. So there were two of us. And he said, "Do you see that rock up there in the distance?" And both of us nod our head, yes. And he goes, "Walk to that rock, take a right, you're at the camp." And we both looked at him. We're holding our bedrolls, we're holding our things. And I looked at him and he goes, "Don't worry, you stay in the path, you're not going to get shot." And we go through all of that, go through all this massive security to walk almost like free people, to go walk to the actual prison that we're going to.
That's crazy.
It was so bizarre. And I know other people who have gone to camps who have related very similar stories. And so we walk up, and I walk to the camp. And when I see who I'm going to be living with for the next 2 years, I can just see immediately that I'm safe. And that weight of getting raped and getting beaten just fell off of my shoulders. There was still so much uncertainty, but I find this really interesting. That was one of the best nights sleep I had had in 10 months. It was my first night sleep in prison, because there was that uncertainty that we talked about earlier. Yeah. It was, I obviously didn't want to be in prison, but at least I knew where I was going to be for those 2 years. Right. And there's some certainty in that. And I slept really, really well.
Yeah, that's so true. You know, once you get there, you're like, okay, like you're through all the strip searching, you're done with that piece. And then you find out, okay, these are the people, you know, like you said, you walk in and you see all the people and you're like, okay, I'm going to be fine. You know, I'm good. Like, I got this. I still don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but at least I know where I'm going to be laying my head, who I'm going to be sleeping with in my cell, and you know, the general layout of the land that's going to be my home for however long I'm going to be here. And that there's power in that too, you know, and sleeping is so important. And through those 10 months that you were out, you probably barely slept at all. So you get there and you're just like, oh, I can finally, you know, fall asleep and stay asleep and be okay when, you know, knowing that, you know, this certainty is somewhat defined for me now. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, it was those 10 months. You're absolutely right. I slept horribly because we were working so hard. Yeah. She started a vintage furniture business. So that involves a lot of early mornings getting to estate sales and getting to flea markets before everybody else to get the good stuff. And it involves a tremendous amount of physical labor. So we were, it's very hard work. And on top of that, I was drinking tremendously. I was just drinking to drown the pain away. And so going to prison, you know, there was no more of that tremendously hard physical labor. There was obviously no more alcohol. Right. And it still had that uncertainty, but everything you just said, it's like, it's a little, it's just that relief. It's just knowing where you're going to be is so huge. And then I made friends very quickly. I made friends extremely quickly. People found out that I used to be a personal trainer in my 20s. So all of a sudden I've got a roster of personal training clients.
Oh, nice.
We were fortunate. We had, you know, out in the real world, it would be considered a very crummy gym. Inside prison, this thing was great. It was a good prison gym. Nobody would ever tolerate it. Like I said, out in the real world,
yeah.
it was really good. So I found myself in the gym, gave me a sense of purpose, gave me something to do, to write programs for my clients, some of which who had some, you know, interesting physical problems that I had to take into consideration. And it was fun connecting with something that I really enjoyed doing that I hadn't done in 20 years.
Yeah.
But there was, you know, I was fortunate. I started practicing yoga, which is, you know, really, that was really cool. I cannot express enough gratitude for the prison I was in and the people that I met and the fact that I was safe. And I think this next part is really important because I think this is where everybody, whether or not you're, you know, you may not know what physical prison is like, but my hell and my torture was the mental prison.
Yeah.
And my physical was fine, but the mental was where I suffered.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know, like we, the mental prisons, like I love how you, you know, described all this in your book and how you talked about when you were in prison, like you, you know, you did say in your book, like how, like you were safe and you made friends and all of that, but you were suffering inside and, you know, you wanted to end it all. So can you tell us more about that mental prison that you felt trapped in while you were there?
It was, you said the word earlier, and I think this is such a, it's such an important word to discuss and to, because when we discuss it, we diffuse it. Shame.
Yeah.
I experienced just pure shame. I knew what I was doing was wrong. It caught up to me. And the pain that I caused to my wife and to my family and to myself, it just became so much and so strong. I had this one moment in prison where I'd been there just a couple of months, and it was a beautiful fall day. I'm sitting at the picnic table by myself. Some folks are playing handball. There's rap music coming from the gym. And I'm just kind of, I start daydreaming a little bit. I kind of go somewhere else, and I received what honestly just felt like a direct download from the universe of what's important in life: family, friends, freedom, choice, creativity, all these things that don't cost anything. And it was just such a pure and powerful message. And I realized I was chasing all the wrong things with my material excess, with the cars, with the watches, with the fancy dinners, that everything that's important in life doesn't cost anything and was available to me and in front of me all the time. And it made me feel so good at first to receive this. I was like, I get it. I'm not going to screw this up. I totally get it. But then I realized I'm in prison. And I said, I'm going to die before I get to put this into practice. And that was just the level of shame I was feeling. And then on December 22nd, so 3 days before Christmas, in the prison visiting room, my wife told me that she was leaving me. And I'd been in for about 4.5 months at that point, dealing with that shame, dealing with the fact that what makes life beautiful was in front of me and I ignored it. And that just really put a pin in it, if you right. will, where I just fell to my absolute rock bottom, where my mind concocted a short video of what it would look like to kill myself. And it was me in a basement with a black hood over my head, sitting on a chair, reaching under the chair, pulling out a pistol, and pulling the trigger. And it was so real. And it was so utterly painful because it started playing video at first, and I waved it off. I waved my brain off. I said, no, I don't want to see this. And I thought I could wave it off, but then it just started playing on repeat every second of every day for 4 months straight. And it was digging into my brain. It was creating its own neural pathway. I could actually taste the cloth. I could feel the bullet. Everything became more and more real. And I had to make that stop. And that's when I started to plan how I was going to kill myself. And I think that just speaks to the power of shame. And I couldn't tell anybody in prison what I was experiencing, because if you mention suicide in prison, they lock you in solitary. And here I am already feeling completely isolated, even though I was surrounded by some wonderful, wonderful people. But I couldn't share with them because I was afraid that they would tell a guard, that they would tell some official, and then, you know, they would, for out of my protection, and then I'm in solitary. So I'm just so lost, so alone, and bottling all of this up. I had to make it stop. And that's when I started planning how I was going to kill myself.
Wow. Yeah, that's, you know, the shame around, you know, when we experience things in life, especially going to prison and jail, like that shame is so powerful and it can overtake your entire mind. Like you said, you know, for me, I was pregnant when I was in jail. So I did think about ending it before I went to jail, but I couldn't because of the child that was, you know, inside of me. She didn't deserve to die, you know, so that's what saved me. But you sit there and you think, like, how did I take all this for granted? I had everything. Like you said, I had my freedom, I had friends, I had family, and I just completely just shut everything out because I was too concerned. You know, for me, it was, I wanted to do drugs. I wanted to party. I didn't want to lose my best friend, you know, and all those things. And you take everything else for granted. And then when you have that time, that silence, because when you're in prison, I mean, you're with your thoughts most of the time, you know, and you sit there and you're like, how did I get here? Like, why am I here? Like, I know now, like you said, like you have that epiphany moment, but then it's like, then reality sets in and you're just like, oh, but I took all of that for granted. So why do I even deserve to have it when this is over? You know, why do I'm not deserving of all these freedoms that I have because I took them for granted and wound myself up in this beautiful place, you know? So, but, you know, then how did you, so let's, you know, talk more about, like, how did you go from, you know, being suicidal to getting yourself to a point where, you know, you kind of flipped the switch, so to speak, and were able to see, you know, the light and bring in good things into your life? Like, how were you able to turn that around while you were still in prison?
So the day I was arrested was the day that my life changed. The day that I'm going to talk about right now was the next day that my life changed. I was living with that vision of my suicide, that short video, for 4 months. Couldn't tell anybody. And out of the blue, my best friend, Sean, sends me an email. I've known Sean for 30 plus years. He is my go-to guy, amazing, incredible human being. And he just said, hey, man, can I come for a visit this Saturday? And visits are not monitored. So I can tell Sean what I'm experiencing, that I'm not well, that I need help. And even knowing that he was coming, it took a little bit of that pressure off. I was so excited to be able to sit down with my best friend and tell him everything that was going on in my brain that I couldn't share with anybody else. Sean arrives, we sit down, we get some of the, you know, the crappy food out of the vending machines, and I go to speak. And I cannot tell you how excited I am to, like, get this out. I open my mouth. Sean beats me to the punch. He beats me to it. And he just starts saying that his life is a mess. He's getting a divorce. He's got money issues. He's got job issues. And there's such a sadness in my friend's voice and in his eyes that in our 30 plus years of friendship, I've never seen. And it was at that moment where I understood that I had value and worth outside of everything that I had always thought made me worthy. I was not my cars. I was not my watches. I was not my fancy dinners. I was a friend and nothing more. And when I realized I had value and that I had worth, that completely turned my life around. I was still a mess, but I was no longer suicidal. And that is, it's funny. I've been writing for, you know, Instagram and LinkedIn and all those things. And I wrote a few posts about the power of okay and how being okay is underrated. And so I went from being suicidal to being okay. And let me tell you something, what a huge leap that is. Because I didn't need to go from suicidal to being extraordinary. I just needed to be okay. And that's what Sean's visit did. It brought me back into reality and told me that it was okay. And then from there, I started doing, you said something so interesting earlier. How did I get here? Why am I here? What, you know, you started asking questions. And that really, I was asking them before Sean's visit, but the answers were very much filled with shame. Still asking those same questions, but because of Sean's visit and the fact that I understood that I had value, I was able to really look at those. There was still shame, but I could look at why I made the choices I made. And that really started opening me up to completely rebuilding and reinventing my life. Because when I started understanding why I did what I did, it gave me an area to start focusing on. You know, I never thought that I was worthy of my success. I didn't think that I was worthy of my wife. So why? Why was that? So I got to look into those things and realize that I really need to show myself and teach myself that I'm worthy. And that was the day that everything turned for me.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, how we take, like we were talking before about how we took, you know, both of us took for granted, you know, what we had, and your friend simply visiting you just made that light switch go in your head, like, oh, you know, like, okay, like I'm more than materialistic things. He came to me because he sees me as a friend, and that meant the world to you. And that was what made you go, okay, like, I can be okay. I'm okay. I don't need to end my life. I can get through this. No, you know, you weren't like sunshine and rainbows dancing around having parties, but you were okay. And that's what matters, you know, because your life does matter. Everyone's lives matter. And that's very powerful. So could you tell us, you know, I want to talk more about your book. So can you tell us, like, why did you write Blank Canvas?
I started writing in prison, and I started writing because I didn't have that outlet before Sean's visit. I didn't have that outlet. And so I started writing to get the words out. And it was so painful to write what I was writing about, but it allowed me to process some of the thoughts. The first draft of the book was so filled with shame and self-loathing and hatred and just trying to process everything. But it really helped. It's not an understatement to say that writing also helped save my life. It was one of the, and it's still to this day, I journal every single day. I write every single day. It's just something that I connect with that I think is so wonderfully simple and so powerful. So I'm sitting in prison and I'm writing about getting arrested by the FBI, my wife telling me that she's leaving me. I mean, these things only just occurred. So it is like a big gaping wound that I'm pouring bleach on, essentially. It just hurts. And I remember throwing my pen in disgust because I said, why am I doing this? What I'm writing is torturing me, and I'm already in prison. Isn't that torture enough? I know how hard it is to get a book published. It's next to impossible, but it is possible. but you know, and who's going to read this thing? And I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And I throw that pen and I go, why am I doing this? And my heart spoke, and I turned the page in my journal and I wrote the answer down. And I still have this journal somewhere and I want to find it. But the answer was, to help one person.
Wow.
And I would flip the page back to where I was writing earlier, and I continued to write about what I was writing about, and the pain wasn't that bad. And that was the fuel that carried me from writing that first word to having it published May 25th of this year, just under 7 years. It was just under 7 years of work to create Blank Canvas. And the fuel was to help one person through every down that I experienced. And there were a lot of them, because it took about 6 years to actually write it and 8 drafts.
Wow.
Hemingway said that something along these lines, there's nothing to writing. You just cut yourself open and bleed. And I really love that quote. And when I wrote the first draft, I realized that I hadn't even broken the skin. I hadn't cut myself open. I scratched myself. So I said, I can go deeper. And so the second draft, I went deeper. And I kept challenging myself all the way through that 8th draft to get to the truth, to get to just the raw, real truth of my experience. With that fuel of helping one person, I knew that I wouldn't be able to help that one person if I tried to obscure something, if I tried to use a $10 word when a $1 word would suffice.
Right.
I had to just get to the realness of it, because that's how I was going to help somebody. And it was, writing that book was one of the most painful things I've ever done, but it was also such a catharsis. Yeah. It was such a transformative journey to revisit those painful moments and to get them out of me. And I'm super proud of how it came out. I'm thrilled with how it came out. And I do hope it reaches that one person who feels right now how I once felt. And I hope it adds value to them.
Yeah, you should be proud. Your book is amazing. I know for me, you know, I've overcome my time in jail and I'm here telling my story, but I will tell you that it did help me, because I now know that I'm not the only one who felt that way. You know, when we first met and we first started talking, I was like, whoa, you know, like, you get it. I'm not alone. I'm not the only person who's been to jail who felt like I had a red letter on me that says I'm a felon. I'm not the only one who experienced all these horrible things, that I want to share them with the world too, you know, because it's so powerful to know that you're not alone. And you definitely, with your book and just meeting you, made me feel like, okay, I'm not alone. I can do this. I can share my story and help other people. So it's very powerful. So anyone's listening, please get Blank Canvas by Craig Sandland. Everyone needs to read it. Whether you've been to prison, whether you haven't, you need to read it. It's a story for everyone, for sure.
That means so much to me, Amanda. Thank you so much for that. And I would love to just really quickly, if you don't mind, jump on something you said in there. And that is the feeling of being alone. That mm-hmm. shame. That is pure shame that tells us that we're alone. That tells us that we are the only person in the universe who feels right now how we feel. That is shame. And when we start sharing our stories, whatever they may be, somebody may not understand what it's like to go to prison, but they know what shame feels like. Our stories are the vehicles for our emotions, and our emotions are where we connect as human beings. So when we share our stories and the emotions behind them, we connect with others and we let others know that they're not alone. And when we let somebody know that they're not alone, not only do we help them, but because we've shined a light on our own shame, we start unraveling our own shame, and we give others permission to do the same. And when we start doing that, it creates just this beautiful and powerful cycle. Because when we feel alone, that's when we start thinking about really scary things. We start making very bad decisions and very bad choices. But when we realize that we're not alone, it puts us back to that, okay. And realizing that there's a community and there's a sense of oneness with others. So I just wanted to add that in there.
Yeah, I love that, you know, because like you said, for me, I've lived in shame because I've been out of jail for, goodness, I think like 13, 14 years now. And I lived in that shame for the majority of those years. So, you know, and it ate me alive. I made horrible decisions based on my shame because I didn't want anyone to know. You know, if people find out, you know, they're not going to accept me anymore. I'm not going to be able to get this job or whatever. So I was living in shame and guilt and fear for over a decade. And it was eating me alive. And it wasn't until this past year that I just decided, you know what? I'm done with that. I can't anymore. Like, I need to get this out. And you have definitely, you know, helped me, you know, even though like I met you like towards like after already making that choice, but you made it less afraid to share the felon part, you know, because that's the part that scares me the most, telling the world I'm a convicted felon. Because how many people have I met over this past decade that didn't know that I hid that from them? So it's scary, you know, but at the same time, now that I feel so not alone in that, I feel even more empowered to do so. So it's very powerful. So for just to wrap this up, I could talk seriously, Craig. I'm going to have you back on because we just have to keep this conversation going. But could you let the audience know what's your number one tip for them to be able to let the good things into their lives?
I hope you don't get mad at me. I'm going to cheat and give you two.
No, that's fine.
because they're both super important. To allow the good things into our lives, we have to know that we're worthy of the good things in our lives. And I would ask anybody who, when I was in prison, I would punish myself. And I did this before prison, and I did it post-prison. There would be these small punishments. So I'll give the example of prison. I didn't allow myself to watch television for a long time when I was in prison because of everything I've done. Who am I to watch television? And that was a penance that I put upon myself. How am I ever going to be worthy if I can't watch TV? And so I'd ask anybody, if there is something that you enjoy doing, but you're not doing it because you don't feel worthy, to look at that and start scheduling time to do that, to reinforce that worthiness so that you do open yourself up to the good things in the world that are there. And then number two is gratitude, mm-hmm. is expressing gratitude to allow the good things into our life. Gratitude rewires our brain from scarcity to abundance. And when we're feeling abundant, we're more open to seeing all the good that may already be there, that may be right in front of us, that we're unaware is in front of us, because we're in scarcity mindset. We have blinders on, and we start practicing gratitude on a daily basis, rewiring from that scarcity into abundance. We start seeing more, and we open ourselves up to the good things in this world. I haven't missed probably more than a handful of days of expressing gratitude since prison, so it's 7 years.
Wow.
And it's just been one of three foundational practices that I started in prison that I still do to this day. The other two are journaling and meditation.
Wow, powerful. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And thank you so much for being here on the Let Good Things In show. I'm so grateful to have had you as a guest.
I'm so happy to have met you and to have this conversation. And if you don't mind me taking a moment to acknowledge you for doing this podcast, for providing a platform for people to share their stories, to help unwind that shame and to connect with our emotions and to share so openly your story. So I acknowledge you for that and I appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you. That almost made me cry. But thank you so much again, Craig. This has been fantastic. And for everyone listening out there, just remember that you are stronger than you think, and you are more than capable of having the life you imagine having, regardless what has happened to you in the past. And make sure to hit that subscribe or follow button so you don't miss an episode of the Let Good Things In show. And I will talk to you all soon.